How's it going, everybody? We're back with another edition of the Ad Podcast. And today we have a storied strategist from deep agency land, working at storied shops like White & Kennedy, TBWA, and Arnold across massive brands like Dell, Jack Daniels, Verizon, and Progressive. Kieran Monahan, thanks for coming on the show, man.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Awesome. So I know I gave a little bit of background there, but do you want to maybe walk us through some of the highlights in your career as you kind of climbed the ladder at these amazing agencies and got to work on some of these really cool campaigns and then kind of broke out on your own?
Sure. Yeah, no worries. So I started a while ago, really cut my teeth at Grey in London, working on Procter & Gamble. I'd done a business studies degree in England and love the idea of getting into advertising. I'd read Reese and Trout's book, Positioning the Battlefield Mind, and I was like, I don't know what these guys do, but I want a piece of it. and that's how I got into advertising. And I sort of really cut my teeth on Procter & Gamble, which was, with benefit of hindsight, you know, which is 2020 vision, but it was great, great schooling, because there was on one hand, there was the qualitative side of things, but there's also a huge focus on quantitative and understanding like real insights from data back. And this is back before there was, showing my age, back before there was an internet that anyone was actually using.
Right.
So it was a lot of, you know, number crunching, and really using that to, I guess I really understood and learned how to construct an argument, for a strategy back then. So, and then moved on to, the Saatchi organization of the MNC Saatchi, which was the new Saatchi agency when Charles and Morris had left Saatchi and Saatchi. And, it was an amazing time. It was a big, big startup. The building in Golden Square in London was a building site. It was a construction site.
Wow.
I had a client who refused to come to the office for meetings because there was too much brick dust all over the furniture. So I worked on British Airways back then, which at the time was one of the biggest companies in the world, and really kind of understood a lot there from MNC Saatchi. You have this concept of the brutal simplicity of thought. So really kind of learned about how important it is to make things simple, and frankly, how hard it is to make things simple. So there's that great quote, which is either Mark Twain or Winston Churchill of, sorry, I didn't write you a shorter letter, but I didn't have the time. And that really is like the essence of simplifying something down is, it, you know, it takes time, it takes some experience. So I went from there and had a great time at Saatchi and then got offered a role at TBWA in London, running the PlayStation group, which was just very difficult to turn down. And just a fantastic 3 or 4 years at TBWA there, an incredible time of creative success, new business success. And PlayStation was a real kind of privilege to work on something like that. Our client at the time, David Patton, he's probably one of the most awarded clients in advertising anywhere in the world. Just a guy who knew how to really push the agency hard, but also how to buy great work. And he just got us to a better place, you know. Trevor Beatty was the creative director. So he's a really sort of storied and infamous creative director in certainly in London ad circles and European ad circles.
Yeah, I think that you want a statue on the stuff you guys did with David Lynch, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's the we basically getting David Lynch was a real kind of coup, because at the time he just didn't direct ads, and we sent him. It was very difficult to do anything on PlayStation creatively because the bar was so high that it was like, well, that's great, we just got that last campaign out, but what the hell are we going to do next? And we actually had we sent him, it was this lyrics to a Tom Waits song. It was just a very sort of, say a song, it was more like a sort of piece of sound design. It was just a very kind of left field approach to developing advertising, and Lynch absolutely loved it. And so, yeah, so he got to go out to LA and spend a couple of days on set with David Lynch shooting this this launch commercial for PlayStation 2, which ran pretty much everywhere in the world apart from the North America and Japan, where they had their own agencies doing it. But we did the work for the rest of the world. I think it ran in like 100 countries or something like that. So that was like super proud of that. And then I'd always wanted to go and work abroad. And TBWA had started talking to me about going to New York. And that really whet my appetite for it. And then for a bunch of reasons, internal reasons, that opportunity, just the window wasn't really open at that time. But I got a call about going to Amsterdam to work at Wyden and Kennedy on Vodafone, which is Verizon in the US, had just bought all these mobile cell phone companies across Europe, and now they were rebranding them all Vodafone. So we need to do a launch campaign for Vodafone across, I think it was like 22 countries or something. I went to Wyden Kennedy to Amsterdam, and was at Wyden and then at 180, which is, everyone seemed to work at Wyden and 180 at some point in their career in Amsterdam. I worked on the Olympic campaign for Adidas, so the Impossible is Nothing campaign. And then had 3 years in Amsterdam and really fantastic experience, an amazing place to live actually.
Yeah. I've traveled there a few times for Adobe used to go to the International Broadcasters Conference there once a year. And I went there 3 times for IBC. And yeah, what a cool country. I mean, so many people think about it from the perspective of like, you know, maybe marijuana tourism or the red light district or this or that. But it's such a cool city above and beyond that, you know, the architecture, the canal system, you know, amazing places like the Modern Art Museum or the Anne Frank House.
Yeah.
I've been able to bring my family with me at least on one of those IBC trips. And, you know, it's an amazing city.
Yeah, that's great. That's, I mean, it was the thing that was really struck me when I got there was, I think at Wyden's at the time we had, there's about 140 people in the office. And we had something like 36 different languages spoken in the office because it was such a, Amsterdam is such a melting pot, a true melting pot mm-hmm. of people. But of course, English is the sort of common denominator. It really kind of was funny when I first got there, people were sort of saying, you know, you'll understand why people are like, oh, it's somebody else who's come over from a big London agency. And I was like, I really don't understand why, what the difference is, but it doesn't take very long before you really understand that when you're working with all these people and their first language isn't English, you really have to listen a lot more to what people are saying. And you really have to sort of understand what they're saying, like a little bit below the surface of maybe what they're saying. And of course, also like wonderful experience of different people just coming from different countries and different cultures did bring a very, very different perspective. So when you're in a creative development process, really fascinating, you know. So there was that. Came back to London. I'm a Londoner and I live in the States now, but I really love London and I was kind of missing it. And came back and ended up working at Low Worldwide as the chief strategy officer for the Nokia business, which was, I was employed by Low Worldwide, but it was actually an IPG level role. So we had this just ridiculous size team. It was, I think we had like 140 something people. It was as big as Wyden Kennedy. Wow. Working on Nokia across 6 different interpublic group agencies. And it was funny. It was, you know, I mean, it was a little bit political within interpublic group because you've got all of these pretty powerful CEOs who have got a big chunk of Nokia business. But, you know, Bob Greenberg really wanted to lead Nokia from a digital perspective and Low was the lead strategic agency. So, I had a group of about 20 odd strategists and we were just a team that always played nicely together. Because I think that with planners and strategists, I think my experience is mainly that you just really wanted to solve a problem. Mm-hmm. And there's some egos, but I think mainly people just wanted to work with other smart people and get to the bottom of things. So that was kind of really, really fascinating to work in a company that was spending, you know, $1 billion a year worldwide on on media, on paid media. Really about the time, this is 2007 to 2009, 2010. So really about the time when WebPoint 2.0 had come in and people were trying to figure out how to use digital platforms and digital media. Just a real kind of interesting transition in the world of advertising at that time. And then I ended up working, the Nokia business, kind of the iPhone had come in, Nokia kind of had a bit, took a bit of a hit. The account just, they just wanted to run the account in a very, very different way rather than having a huge integrated team. So I ended up starting to freelance a little bit more and worked with FCB, with an agency that eventually became FCB in London. Mm-hmm. And that was really the sort of start when that was my first kind of proper freelance period. Just really great people I was working with there. And then got a call about coming to the States, to Boston, to work on the Dell B2B business. Mm. And the recruiter said to me, like, you know, the good news is there's a job in the States. And I said to her that I would be interested in working in the States at some point. And said that it's a great job. And I think that you've got a great chance of getting it. The downside is it's in Boston. And I'd actually spent, she's like, it's not New York, it's not LA. And I'd spent a year in Boston when I was at university. So I got a ton of friends there. I support all the Boston teams. So I was like, you're kidding me. This is like perfect.
Wow.
So it just was a real sort of point of serendipity. So that's when they made the move over to the States, which was now amazing. It's 12 years ago now. So I spent about 3 years at Arnold, first running Dell and then getting on to working with Progressive and did a big global brand strategy for Jack Daniels. Then got another kind of call from, there was a big philanthropist in Boston and a friend of mine worked with him. And he'd got something that was very, very different, a healthcare company that he was looking for help with on a brand and a strategy side. And so I sort of left Arnold and went out on my own. That's when I started doing my own consulting work. Ended up forming Not Pluto and worked for various smaller companies, mainly smaller brands, mainly in Boston. Then at the beginning of the pandemic, moved down to Austin, Texas, which is where I am now, which again was for a business thing. I had someone I was doing a lot of work with down here. So I moved down to Austin, and this is now another kind of really interesting sort of melting pot of it, in fascinating city. I'm not going to get political or anything, but it's a blue dot in the middle of a red sea in the States.
I think they call it the Hollywood of Texas, right?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. It's literally, I say to my friends in Boston, it's so liberal in Austin, it makes most of Massachusetts look like this vaguely Republican.
Wow.
So it's very, you know, South by Southwest is here that just finished a couple of weeks ago. So a real kind of melting pot. So that's kind of like a, hopefully not too long a,
nah, I love
a
it.
Summary of the journey of getting here. And it's been quite a ride.
Yeah, I love it. So I want to kind of hop in next and talk a little bit about, you know, your marketing philosophies and kind of how you approach strategy and creative. So I was watching an interview you did with a colleague this morning where you talk about, you know, kind of the foundational components of any brand is really getting the mission straight. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about why the mission is so important to kind of brand strategy and foundational work before you
branch out to
logo and colors and all the other branding elements?
Yeah, right. I mean, definitely. I mean, obviously a lot of people think brand or branding and they think of the executional side of it and the identity side of it. But ultimately, to me, whether you call it your mission or you call it your purpose, it's the same thing. And it's not rocket science. It's basically the sort of strategic stake that you stick in the ground. And like, this is why we exist as a brand and the problem we're trying to solve with people. So, you know, infamous purpose statements for me are, you know, Apple's create Apple's create technology, we exist to create technology for, sorry, we make technology to, I've gone completely blank on it. Let me go to Google's. I'll come back to Apple's because I've got back to the Apple thing.
Yeah, or Google. another one I heard you mention is the idea that at Nike, you know, everybody is an athlete is kind of their core.
That's athlete. Right. Yeah, that's one of their initial.
Like beliefs. No matter where you are in your journey, if you decide you're an athlete, you're an athlete.
That's right. Yeah, it's like if you have a body, you are an athlete. So basically. That was their kind of mantra. Apple's is to make technology easy to use for the everyman. Hmm. And you can see how they set out to do that and how they're still doing that today. Google's is to organize the world's information, making it accessible and useful. Hmm. So it's a stake in the ground, and it's not just for the creative. Oh, it's for the brand in its totality. So it's a brand touches everything. It touches all its all touch points, whether it's HR or sales or production or manufacturing or whatever. It's a great sort of stake to put in the ground. I've got a great quote here, actually. I'm going to read you, which is from, I often use this quote when I'm talking to clients early on about the point of purpose. And I use this because it's from Larry Fink, who's the chief executive officer of BlackRock Investments, biggest asset manager in the world. And he, his quote is, profits and purpose are inextricably linked. Mm. When a company truly understands and expresses its purpose, it functions with focus and strategic discipline within a framework for consistent decision-making. Purpose unifies management, employees, and communities, drives ethical behavior, and guides culture. Companies that fulfill their purpose and responsibilities to stakeholders reap rewards over the long term. Companies that ignore them stumble and fail. So, I mean, it's a little bit of a long quote, but to me, what he's talking about there is that, first of all, your purpose and or your mission is inextricably linked to profits. And he talks about how it affects stakeholders. He doesn't talk about shareholders, and yet he's a finance guy. Yeah, so he's right. Talking about all stakeholders. And I did a project with a client 3 or 4 years ago. I run this process I call Brand Camp, and it's probably like a 8-week, 12-week process. But we have a big 2-day workshop early on in the process, and we bring all the stakeholders from the company together into a room. And I was debriefing the senior client a week after we'd had the workshop. And he sort of sat there and listened to us, and he didn't really say anything for about an hour. And at the end of it, he just like finished, and he just went, okay, he goes, I think I've got it now. When you say brand, you mean all of it. You mean everything. And I'm like, yeah, that's exactly it. It's everything. And it was really fascinating to me, because with the very greatest of respect to the client, who's one of the smartest people I've ever met, he wasn't a brand guy. He was a tech guy. And it was really fascinating to see like the penny drop, and then went on to work with, it was a company called Connection. They're an IT reseller, and that's about as hardcore B2B as you can imagine. And yet he really understood what we were talking about. And we ended up creating this campaign called the IT Superheroes. And we had a campaign called For Pete's Sake, and we had this IT superhero called Pete. Who every day faces challenges of insurmountable odds with all of his colleagues around him, with all their lack of IT skills, and every day he saves the day because he has the backing of Connection. But it was, you know, we were involved with their HR people, with how they introduce the company when they're hiring people. We were, you know, consulting with the CEO when he was writing his introductory speech to their big conferences. So I think that's really what, when you come to mission and purpose, it's really about the, and everyone, lots of people talk about the why, and obviously Simon Sinek did like a fantastic YouTube video of, you know, start with why, but it really is that. It's just to get everyone around the same, singing off the same hymn sheet. And it's ultimately, you know, we do brand and we do creative, and it's great fun and everything. But at the end of the day, it's about driving profits for for the organization to profit, whether that's a for-profit company or even if it's a charity, they need to profit out of that in terms of the outcome of whatever it is we're doing. So that's kind of why I think mission and purpose is just so critical. Because if you don't get that right, then you're just band-aiding everything forever.
Yeah, it seems like you really hit on that other note, which I think is what makes effective B2B marketing. And it's really about dialing down to that ideal customer profile and understanding how to make them feel like they're the superhero within their organization, right?
Right, yeah.
You know, a lot of times IT is fairly invisible and they're maybe even made fun of as kind of like nerds and guys that are, you know, tech heads and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, you know, we see all this stuff these days about hacks and, you know, ransomware. And these are the guys that essentially keep all that stuff, you know, at bay, hopefully.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'd done some research when I was working with Dell, which ended up helping there, and Connection were a partner of Dell's. It ended up really helping us with the Connection work. And we'd ask one question in the discussion guide, which was, if you were a character from popular culture, who would you be? And without exception, everyone that we'd interviewed in this, it was qualitative research, they all basically picked a superhero, or two of them picked MacGyver, but same thing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. And they were, not only were they picking themselves as superheroes, but they had a reason that the superhero they chose. So it was like, I feel like I'm Spider-Man because I have to stick everything together and make it work with very little, you know. I'm like Superman because I feel like I'm always surrounded by kryptonite. They had a reason that they really felt like they picked their superhero. And that was great. You know, that's proper insight, which obviously is another really critical part of being a good strategist, is being able to understand what is a true insight versus what is a, you know, what's just an observation or a fact. Because you can inspire creative work and brand strategy with insight, but you can't inspire creative development with fact. What's that David Ogilvy great quote he got, which was, observation and fact should be used much like a drunk uses a lamppost for illumination, for support, not illumination. So, you know, it was great. It was really, really insightful work. And IT people are superheroes. They are. When they start talking about soldering things together with a paperclip, because they literally had no time to do it, then you know what's really happening in the background.
I love that. So, you talked in another interview about the importance of strategy and creative actually being linked together, and that some brands like to silo off, you know, strategy, creative, and media, sometimes even with different agencies in competing holding companies or competing resources. And I suppose, you know, some CMOs like to do that to keep everybody honest and feel like they're all, you know, working on their piece of the pie. But why is your philosophy that strategy and creative should be, you know, seamlessly interlinked?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately it just comes down to the consistency of strategy through to message. And, you know, there's different ways of doing it. My philosophy is that I always think that the best people in our business are, the best strategists are 80% strategists and 20% creative. And the best creatives are 80% creative and 20% strategists. And rather than it being like passing a baton from a strategist who's got a PowerPoint deck through to someone else who's then going to take that PowerPoint deck and then interpret that, you know, they're going to put their own interpretation into that. And, you know, look, I'm not saying that that's never worked, because there have been a lot of, you know, successful campaigns, I guess, that have worked like that. But I just don't think it's the most efficient way of doing it. I think that if you have the right people, then as you're developing the strategy, you really start to unearth the insights that are going to get you to the best creative. And there's, to me, there's nothing better than involving the creative folks a little bit earlier in the process, so they really understand strategically what it is we're trying to get there, and for them to have some genuine ownership of the strategy development, because then they're more likely to be inspired to develop better creative work. And I think at the end of the day, it just comes down to, in my experience, whenever there's been the pass of the baton, there's always a big, there's a time suck. Because there is literally it's an efficiency thing as much as anything else. Because you have to hand it over to somebody else, and then they have to start pretty much from scratch, whatever it is you've presented to them. It's just not a way that I just don't particularly enjoy working like that. And I think the better work comes out when you've got a team that can take it from strategy all the way through creative, and when creatives and clients, frankly, feel ownership of the strategic development as well as the creative development.
Yeah, I like that. And then you also talked about, especially in startup brands or new brands, the importance of investing in copywriting and good design way earlier in the process that a lot of founders start with. Sometimes it feels like, maybe those are luxurious assets to have, freelance or full-time assets in-house. But why is it important to get those two components right as early as possible within brand development?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is to do with, or maybe all of it is to do with, establishing a really strong brand voice as early as possible. Because again, that is something around which everyone in the company and all stakeholders it starts to just inspire them. And it makes the messaging clearer of what that startup is trying to achieve. I mean, I got a really good example with fantastic startup, healthcare startup called Bowie Health in Boston that I've worked with over the years. And they made what I felt was, and actually had a big influence on my view that of the power of bringing in design and writing early. They hired their first designer, who is still their head of design, very early in the process. And it really made a big difference in terms of the simplicity of the way that they were able to present their own message, the simplicity in their UX and their UI. So it's not just about advertising. Again, the brand is all. So it really helped them in the way that they were messaging to their potential customers and, frankly, investors. That they got a very simple value prop, and they got it felt like a very simple, very welcoming, very warm company to deal with. And frankly, if they hadn't even invested in design at the very beginning of that, they just wouldn't have had the same, it just wouldn't have felt as warm and welcoming. And it was, I don't know where it would have been, but it was a real struggle. And it was also in their early discussions as a startup, and I'm talking in the first year, the one thing that kept coming up in their internal staff meetings was about, we really need to sort the brand out. So it wasn't something that was just there because it was a nice to have. It was something that their team, at the time, I think their team was about 9 or 10 people. And it was all with different responsibilities. There was a small dev team, there's the CEO, there's the head of product. And they're all talking about, we really need to sort the brand out, because there was no glue that was integrating them. And it really helped them to do that. So
that's cool. Yeah. I was researching another company that you work with. Their name escapes me, but they're an automotive client that create software, I think a SaaS platform for the automotive industry.
Space Auto, yeah.
Yeah, Space Auto. And what I was really stricken by their website, that it doesn't look like a traditional SaaS company or a traditional brand that you would see servicing the automotive industry. It was very clean and not a lot of pitch and jargon and technical. Yep. Sometimes you go to B2B companies' websites and you need a third party interpreter in order to understand what the hell they're saying. And it felt like this site was very much more focused on here's how we help our customers and almost like what you were talking about and the empowerment of that IT services buyer with the client that was working with Dell. It was like, here's how we make your life easy. Here's how we make you feel. The design was very polished and simplistic. I felt like that same thought kind of transitioned into that work as well.
Yeah, 100%. And I thank you. I'm delighted to hear that that's just what you take out of it. And so, yeah, so it's, you can see the website at space.auto is the URL. And when I started working, I actually work now as their sort of fractional CMO. Mm. So it sort of takes up a couple of days a week of my time. Fantastic company, fantastic products. They're a sort of 37 person startup, raised a $5 million Series A middle of last year. So really going somewhere. And at the time, they, very creative group of people, but at the time their website felt like a B2B website and they knew it and they were frustrated. And we did a lot of work on their brand. We went through the brand camp process, got them to a really clear purpose, and then they got some really good internal design and production team resources and assets and stuff. So I just said, look, you know, the website needs to feel like it's a very human company. I come up with this kind of like a brand idea of Easy Does It. Because it felt to me, that really to me came to me from the culture of the company, because of the way that they were designing products and the way the developers talked about what they were trying to do for users and, you know, this sort of thing. And their head of product design is actually also a very good web designer. And so he did the design and he did the first version of it and he showed it to me. And he's like, yeah, man, I really think this is cool, but, you know, I've got a couple of other ideas and, you know, I'd like to show you a couple of other ideas. And I said to him, why? I was like, this is fantastic. I was like, why would you go spend more time trying to come up with something else? I was like, I genuinely feel that as well about the where it had got to with the design. I just said, I just don't feel like you're going to get anything better than this. And this is fantastic. So let's just get on it. And we, from seeing the first design to having the website live, was took us about, I think it was like 10 weeks. Mm. And we really kind of, you know, we really ran at it. But then we produced our first piece of content. And one thing that for Space Auto and frankly for any B2B business is, you know, testimonials are really powerful, but testimonials are really, really fucking boring. They'd done these testimonials that were on their previous website. And I was watching them. I'm just like, you know, kill me now. I literally said to Nick Askew, who's the CEO, I just said to him, Nick, we need new testimonials. But the problem we've got is that testimonials are fucking boring. So what we're going to do is we're going to go out and make the first non-boring testimonials in the automotive world has ever seen. So what we did was we took some, and you can see them on the homepage of the website now, the film we produced. We got five customers and we flew them out to the BMW Southern Region, one of our clients.
Nice.
So we flew them out to the BMW Performance Center in South Carolina. And so I did these like very straight interviews with them first thing in the morning. And then we put them in a car with a professional race driver, and he slid them around the track at, you know, 60 miles an hour, where a car shouldn't be able to go more than 5 miles an hour. And their hair was flying left, right, and center. And they were swearing and just laughing their heads off. And one guy literally couldn't speak. Another girl, all she could say was yes. We got enough out of it, and you'll see it's like, you know, and we've had incredible success in the category with media partners, with our customers, with new customers. We're using the little 12-second edits of these cuts from the performance center as in retargeting, and they're performing just off the charts. So it's been, you know, really, really successful. But the serious point is that if you treat I always say that business people are people first and then they go to work.
Yeah.
And if you don't treat people when they're at work like they're a human being, then they're not going to notice you, or you know, they're just not going to want to respond to you, never mind remembering you. They're just like, it just puts them off.
Yeah. So, yeah. I love that. And you know what I love, what I like about that even more is, you know, you still stayed true to the vertical, which is automotive, and you know, got one of your partners, BMW, involved. But, you know, what that also strikes me as is like a couple of other use cases. You know, one is it's an experience for your clients, right?
If you're doing
testimonials, theoretically, you're inviting your most important clients to give you those testimonials, you know, because it's credibility building, but it's also using your most important case studies.
Yeah.
And you're taking them out and giving them an opportunity to do something fun and exciting. You know, I see lots of marketing conferences happening at the Porsche Experience out here in LA. And what I also really love about that, and something that I wanted to talk to you later on in the interview, but we'll just jump into it, is the idea that LinkedIn is becoming more important from the perspective of, you know, a social network, an influencer marketing platform. You may have seen just in the last week that LinkedIn announced that they are actually going to have a vertical video stream, not unlike TikTok and YouTube Shorts. So imagine an executive at one of your key clients posting those videos on their own pages, on their own personal LinkedIn pages, and like, hey, look what I did with, you know, with my service provider. That's really great content for them to use as influencers, even if you're not thinking of them as influencers in the traditional sense.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, LinkedIn is really a powerhouse. You know, nearly a billion users, and I think there's nearly 200 million in the US itself. So, and I think there's a lot of noise on LinkedIn, but there's also, if you know the right people to, if you look hard enough, then there's also some fantastic content out there. I'm also a big fan of medium.com. We think it's really high quality writing on there. And so I feel like, you know, LinkedIn, I think those two things can live side by side, but LinkedIn definitely has just some, it's like you can cut through the noise, you can just really come across some incredibly valuable content that really is very insightful and every day we're learning, right? So it's, you can educate yourself a lot with a lot of the stuff that you find on LinkedIn. And those kind of, you know, LinkedIn influencers on LinkedIn, is maybe that's a little bit of a newer thing than LinkedIn on consumer, influencers on consumer media. But certainly there are some great influencers now on and got great profiles on LinkedIn. So I think the video thing is really fascinating on LinkedIn, because a video is just so, film is just so powerful. And to be able to leverage those relatively new formats and to see where LinkedIn are going to take that, that really is going to be interesting.
Yeah, I'm bullish on it. I definitely want to experiment with it. And I feel like it's a great way for, you know, let's hope that they prioritize this feed for the algorithm. So hopefully it will help people grow quicker and reach a larger audience, which I'm assuming they will. I'm a little hesitant because LinkedIn did launch a stories feature when Instagram stories was popular. But maybe it did not get widespread adoption. You know, I have 30,000 followers in my network and I would only see two or three uses a day of it.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking because vertical video, I think LinkedIn was maybe just too early with the stories idea. And now that vertical video has become ubiquitous across all these other platforms, and especially since they're going to create an entirely different feed for the LinkedIn vertical video, I'm excited about, you know, the potential. And I think, but I do see the LinkedIn, you know, influencer audience going kicking and screaming, because so far LinkedIn has had such a low barrier to entry to becoming, you know, building a personal brand and building community, because all you have to do is write, you know, every to I mean, I can't write well, which is why I podcast, but a lot of people can write, and that's the easiest way to kind of get into LinkedIn is write a newsletter, write posts, write blogs. Video is actually harder because people just have that imposter syndrome of not wanting to like see themselves on camera, I think.
For sure. Yeah.
But it'll be exciting to see, you know, folks that can get over that, and everybody has something interesting to say, I think. So
yeah, for sure. I also think it will be interesting to see how maybe the timing is better now for LinkedIn, as you say. Maybe they went a little, they were a little bit early previously because of the fact that you say like vertical video is now an established medium through which to communicate with people. I think it'll also be really interesting to see how people discover what works well on LinkedIn versus what works well on a TikTok or a Instagram or, you know, or Facebook, whatever. It would be really fascinating to see how much of that sort of balance of video being inherently entertaining, but that balance of entertainment versus education and insight and how people create that content. I think that's kind of exciting.
Yeah, me too. Well, we'll see how it all works out.
Yeah.
So I wanted to dive back into another question on around your marketing philosophy. Mm-hmm. So you have a concept around the Verve concept, which was, you know, the example that you gave was, you know, before all of the great insurance advertising that we know and love today, it used to be very boring and conservative until, you know, I don't know who was first. Was it Flo? Was it the Gecko? Was it the Mayhem guy? But somebody had to break out and do it first. And, you know, now the entire industry has moved to that. Can you talk a little bit more about Verve as kind of
Veer. So the Veer philosophy is, it's pretty simple. It's basically, it's a little bit of, if everybody is in one place, then why would you want to be there? So it's really about, it's a little bit of classic, where are we now and where do we want to go? But then how do we get there is where do we veer to get there? And how do we veer away from convention? So I think there's a little bit of let's call it inspiration from TBWA's disruption process, which was about disrupting categories and, you know, things like challenger brands, you know, eating the big fish. Adam Morgan's fantastic book. If anyone's watching this and haven't read Eating the Big Fish, then they should definitely get themselves a copy and read it. It's a fantastic book on challenger brands. And I think the thing with, I think if my insurance history in America is correct, I think that the Gecko was first.
Ah.
And I think that Flow was second. The thing with Flow, the insight with Flow was that buying insurance is incredibly confusing and frustrating. Progressive make it delightful, which is why Flow looks like your favorite diner waitress. And originally, not so much now, but originally she was in this kind of like, actually the insight was it's incredibly difficult to buy insurance. Progressive make it heavenly, feel heavenly. And so that's why she was in this sort of like white world that felt a little bit like you're in, you know, insurance heaven. she's very sort of, you know, approachable kind of character. But Veer is really about, a little bit like what I was just talking about there with the space auto testimonials. You know, the whole market is producing incredibly boring testimonials. Why would we want to add to that pool of boringness? It's just pointless. And at the end of the day, you know, if you look at the work that's been done with fantastic work, the guys down at the university in Southern Australia, around how brands grow, that was really based on you know, proper quantitative academic analysis. The big role that they see from marketing and advertising is to make a brand distinctive. And that's different from differentiating. It's virtually impossible to differentiate today, certainly for any period of time. but you can be distinctive. And it may be that you're giving the same message or a similar message, but you're doing it in a very distinctive way. So the Veer philosophy is really about where we are now, where do we want to get to, but how do we veer away from the conventions of the category to be distinctive versus our competitors? And it's not difficult to do, but it does take a little bit of bravery because, you know, human beings sort of naturally don't want to go and do something crazy and mad, and sort of want to stick to conventional wisdom, but conventional wisdom just puts you in the same place as everybody else. So breakout ideas like flow from progressive, or I'm going to be so bold as to say that our testimonial is a breakout idea because we're getting such great traction from it, is you just need to have a little bit of confidence in yourself and a little bit of confidence in the human race as well, that, you know, people don't want to be bored. They don't want you to come out with something that they've already seen before. They want you to show them something in a different light. So that's really what the Veer philosophy is all about.
Yeah, I like that. And I want to talk to you a little bit about how to work with senior creatives now. You've talked about two different formats. So you've talked about, you know, going off as a freelancer to come on to a project for a period of time. But you've also talked about fractional CMO work. So, you know, which is more long term, more part of the internal team, maybe just not as a full-time asset. Do you have a preference over how you work with clients now as a senior creative? Do you prefer freelance? Do you prefer fractional, or do you like them both?
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. I think I'm a little bit of recency bias is that I'm just really enjoying working with Space Auto. And the reason I'm enjoying it is because as it's not a fixed term project, it's an ongoing project, you really start to get under the skin of the company and what it really makes it tick. And it's really interesting as a kind of a strategist and a creative going from a sort of the agency stroke freelancer side to becoming part of the client side. You just learn a lot more about the business and the category because you spend more time with people internally across the different departments of the company because you have to. So I think there's a lot to be said for the fractional roles. I'm really open to doing right now. That's my one fractional role, and I do a bunch of other projects which tend to be on a sort of, you know, 2-3-4 month period. But I'm really open to the idea of other fractional roles, one or two others to like at the time to do them. And I think that I feel like I probably feel more ownership and pride in the work I'm doing with Space Auto, frankly, than I necessarily have done before. And I felt pretty proud of the work I've done before. So that's not saying I've not felt proud of the work I've done before. I've just been like very proud of the work I've done. And I've just been so lucky to work with so many just fantastic people in this business. I think it's really interesting, actually, when you do go onto a client side, the one big difference is it's made me realize how much energy we get from working in a creative agency or being a freelancer as part of like a creative agency team. And I having done this for many, many years, I've now in the last year started to understand how much I underestimated the value of having all these creative people surrounding you and being able to just nip down the hall and just see someone, just throw a few ideas past them. Because, you know, people in Space Auto are very creatively minded, but not necessarily from a creative advertising and creative brand strategy perspective. They are my client, even though I'm part of the client organization. So it definitely is. It's definitely a different vibe, and you have to. I find different outlets now of like literally connecting and networking with creative people that I normally otherwise would have just had all around me. Now I don't necessarily have them all around me, so the networking side of it becomes even more important. Just to stay connected with that sort of vibe, because ultimately, if you're a proper strategist, you're a creative person, that's your oxygen.
Yeah.
And without it, you start to become a little bit numb.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight. I think it's very applicable to this kind of post-COVID period as well.
Yeah. Where,
you know, prior to COVID, I was in the office in LA 3 days a week and got tremendous value from just the, I guess the kinetic creativity or the proximity, you know, to be able to like go and, you know, shout at somebody across the desk or grab somebody and go to a conference room or lunches and coffees. And, you know, I'm not one advocating for a full return to the office, but I do miss some of that, you know, connectivity. And you bring it up, but an important idea that, you know, you almost have to build that connectivity within your own personal networks now more than ever. You need to have those, you know, folks that are in geographic proximity to you that you can maybe take out for coffee or, you know, the other thing that I noticed from your background is that you're an avid golfer. You know, golf took a great hockey stick during COVID because it was one of the few things that we could do outdoors, you know, without 6 feet of distancing. I think golf was like the first thing to come back, honestly.
Yeah. That's right.
I remember playing a round of golf when they had the cups, you know, 4 inches out of the hole and the ball would not actually drop in the hole because they didn't want people reaching in and
touching in. Yeah.
Yeah. It was the ceramic pin that was stuck in the hole. But, are you able to leverage golf, whether you get other friends from the industry out to spare 4 hours or 3.5 hours to do a round, or how much is golf important to your creative process, both from a networking perspective, business development, et cetera?
Yeah, I think I honestly haven't used it very much for that. I've used it more as a sort of personal escape, to be honest. It's actually a really interesting idea, is to use it as a way to bring some people together. I mean, I'm really lucky here in Austin that the Soho House opened in Austin, Texas. And so I know Soho House well from London. I remember when Soho House opened. So now I'm really giving away my age. And, but Soho House, I use Soho House in Austin almost as like, how I sort of get to touch the stone with other creative people. And have just literally in the last month or so started to realize that if I probably work at home 2 days a week and then go into Soho House 3 days a week, and you just get to know people that are in there because you just see them coming in. And it's almost become my kind of office away from home. And also as part of that, I've realized how important it is to me, just so I can connect with some like-minded, creative-minded human beings. And I've actually started making more of an effort to reach out to people that I've worked with previously throughout my career that I just had a really kind of positive impact on my career, or I just really like them. And just to start reaching out and just touching base with people again for no other reason than just to kind of touch the stone, you know, and just feed off the energy a little bit and hopefully give something back to somebody else too. So it's really important.
No, I love that. I think that's a stark reminder of how important it is as we continue to move to teleworking, you know, through video. You know, one of the things that I've been really intentional about is, you know, trying to get out there and go to conferences more, you know, not just for the sake of business development, since that's my primary responsibility at my agency, but also from the perspective of like, I just used to learn so much from, you know, I remember when I first got into advertising, I didn't know anything. I didn't know what a holding company was. I didn't know what a CPM was. I didn't know about any of this stuff. And I would say, you know, my formal education in advertising came from going to conferences. You know, it was, kind of accelerated learning that those 2 and 3 day sprints. And I'm very lucky that San Diego is a destination market for events. So this week we've got a travel conference in town that I'm setting up some meetings for, and also an online reputation conference And I've actually been really lucky because the podcast gives me a reason to reach out to these organizations and get a free ticket.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
I get credentialed now as an influencer versus having, because it would break the bank pretty quickly if I paid full boat to go to all these things.
It would.
But I imagine you get some of that too. I mean, Austin is such a hub for, you know, talk about South by Southwest as the crown jewel, but like just last week, there was a SaaS open conference in Austin. I feel like there's something going on in Austin that's pretty cool. Like almost.
Yeah, it's definitely a very buzzy place. Again, it's kind of after South by Southwest, I think that was, again, another thing for me of like, I've got to do a lot more of this because just having your eyes open to other perspectives of what's happening in the world. And also, you know, with South by Southwest, there's a lot of focus on AI. Mm-hmm. And when you get to hear, like Amy Webb did a fantastic, she does a keynote every year. And she had a really interesting keynote about how AI and the Internet of Things and the advances in bioscience is really, those three things coming together is what's really starting to affect our world. And I think that AI is just something where everyone can sort of, you know, raise their eyes to the sky when they hear about AI. And it seems like, oh, AI is going to take over our jobs. And it's actually, it's probably going to be more powerful than, but at the same time, there's a lot of analogies to me, you know, between what happened when the internet first appeared versus what's happening when AI is just first appearing. Because, you know, when the internet first appeared, you know, most people didn't have an email address. Then your first email address was probably a Hotmail account. There was no social media. You know, I think I got my first email address in 1994. And, you know, Facebook happened in, 2006, 2007, mm-hmm. Which is when it really started to take off. So there's a lot to learn, and that's the value to me is going, and particularly in the brand and creative world, is I think I was listening to I think it was the Prof G podcast, and he had a guy on there, Scott Galloway, he's great.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, really awesome. He had a guy on there who, I forget his name now, he's something big in AI, the guy really knew what he was talking about, and what was really fascinating, he said, ChatGPT currently has an IQ of about 155. And what's happening in the background, the new AIs that are going to get launched in the next probably 12 months, is that the IQ could literally leap 10x.
Wow.
So if you imagine you've suddenly got an AI with an IQ of 1550, then, because I personally, I think with, you know, using something like ChatGPT, I think that it's really interesting and useful as a way to create some written content that you can then use and go and edit. And I think that what's really kind of ironic is to get something really good out of an AI, now you have to be into what is input engineering or brief engineering, whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like the way to get the good output now, the creative output, is you have to spend an even longer writing the brief.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And it's just, you know, it's an irony, isn't it? It's like the world spins on an ironic axis. And that's kind of the irony of it right now. I think most of the visual stuff that's coming out of AI is just, right now, I'm just not excited by it at all. I think it just has such a look to it. It's like when high definition images first came out in Photoshop, everything looks the same. And it's so clearly AI, but that's a now thing. That's a don't sort of lose your head in this revolution right now, but understand what's coming because it is going to get really interesting. And I don't see it as being something that's going to take people's jobs away. It will take your job away if you don't learn how to use it.
Right.
But if you are just keeping up with the Joneses at minimum, then I think that it could be really fascinating. And we use at Space Auto, we're actually building AIs for the dealership for the SaaS platform.
That's cool.
Which is, it's really cool. And I just like desperately try and keep up with our dev team of what the hell they're talking about. But none of it is about taking, in that instance, jobs away from car dealers. It's actually about making it a lot easier for a dealer and a customer to come together. The way that I put it is that we're building technology that's going to help get technology out of the way.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I have a couple of thoughts there. One is, I saw an interesting LinkedIn post recently where a creative had put a side-by-side of the storyboard for a Comcast business commercial that was generated with Midjourney. So yep. They basically generated the entire storyboard for this ad using Midjourney. And then they showed the side-by-side comparison of the actual finished ad. And if you followed the shot list, it was almost, you know, frame by frame. They truly did use what Midjourney came up with for the full spot. Wow. And then I saw the spot on CNBC on a Shark Tank episode, because I only ever watch TV when I'm in hotels. And right. When I do watch TV, I always tend to stop on CNBC and just play CNBC for the rest of the night.
Yeah.
And it was pretty cool to see, like, okay, well, obviously the AI can't shoot the ad yet or generate the content, but they could generate the story.
Yeah.
They could generate the shot list. Another response that I have to what you mentioned about, you know, AI taking away our jobs. I interviewed Brad DeForest, I think is his name. He's the CEO of Formula Monks, which is the technology consulting and innovation side of S4 Capital over at
Media Monks. Yep.
I interviewed him last week. And what he was expressing to me is the same thing that you're talking about, where AI is just going to help us do the boring parts of our job
right. More.
So then we can actually spend more time together as human beings, you know, interacting in human, because there will be such a, you know, a thirst for that because of like all the things that are happening artificially in the background is going to free us up to really spend most of our time actually connecting as humans again, which I was pretty, you know, excited to hear as a business development person that was, you know, his overview. So,
I couldn't agree more with that. I think that's 100% spot on.
Nice.
Really do. Yeah.
So I know we're coming up on the hour, but I did want to ask you another question about your creative process. So I noticed that you're a pretty heavy photographer. Like, photography is something that you spend a lot of time from a personal perspective.
Yeah.
How does your expressing yourself as a photographer, how does that kind of help you in your creative process?
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. I think what I do, a lot of my photography is landscape, abstract, and a little bit of still life. I love photography. I love all photography. I actually think that the better people become at photography, the better the world becomes, because I always say, like, what I try to do with photography is show people their world in a better light. And I think that what I do when I'm shooting is, there are a lot of photographs that have been taken in the world. And again, sort of going back a little bit to the discussion about the Veer philosophy and about being distinctive, I use photography to try to use that as a way of showing people things in distinctive ways that either they haven't seen before, or maybe they have seen something similar, but they haven't seen it in that kind of way. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the creative process, it's part of an outlet of being able to, when you take a photograph, you're actually creating a photograph. No one wants a snapshot of, unless it was an amazing sort of moment of you with your friends and everything, no one wants a snapshot of a mountain. It's what you're really doing is you're producing an image which in some way conveys how you felt when you were standing there looking at that mountain about to take that image. And at the end of the day, that sort of, you know, great quote of people will forget what you did and they'll forget what you said, but they'll never forget how you made them feel, the Maya Angelou quote. And ultimately, all creativity and being distinctive is always about how you make people feel about something. Because if you can change the way someone feels about something, then you'll change, then they will remember you. But if you can't change, if you show them boring testimonials, you ain't going to change the way that they feel about you. Mm-hmm. But if you show them something which is the not boring testimonial, in that instance, it just make them laugh, but it changes the way that people feel about space. Also, my photography, I hope in some way, changes the way that people feel about something. I mean, I have a still life of some champagne glasses I took, and I shared it on a still life group on Facebook, and it ended up getting nearly 5,000 likes and God knows hundreds of comments, because it's just wow. You have to, if you go to my Instagram, which is just Kieran Monahan, at Kieran Monahan, you'll see it. And it's just a very different perspective of how you look at, it looks like one champagne glass, but there's eight champagne glasses inside the one champagne glass. You just have to look at it. But people were just saying to me, like, how did you do that? And I've never seen anything like this before. And that to me is the best thing, because all I know is that if they have that reaction, then I just feel like I've inspired someone, and maybe 5,000 people, to go out and just look and just look at, to see if they can see the world in a little bit of a different light. Mm. And there's so much, you know, I think at any given time, there's always so much pressure and stress on in the world. And today is no different to any other time. There are some pretty hectic things happening out there. And we, you know, what we do does affect culture, and it does affect how people think about things and how they frame things in their minds. And so if you can do something that changes how someone feels about a topic, then, you know, that's the win, basically. I'm not sure that you can do much more than that. So, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up. Is there anything else you want to plug or let people know how to get in touch with you?
You can check out my Instagram. So it's at Kieran Monahan. You can, if you want to see about Brand Camp, it's trybrandcamp.com. Just visit the website. And if you, anyone's interested, I'm always happy to talk to anybody about, if there's a, the bigger the problem there is, the more interested I am in talking to someone. So it's just, you know, I just get excited by big problems. So anything like that, then yeah, that would be great. But I really appreciate you inviting me on the pod. It's been great fun, and congratulations on the pod. It's always great, very interesting episodes. So
I appreciate you as well. So for all of you that are following along at home, if you enjoyed my conversation with Kieran today, don't forget to subscribe wherever you happen to be listening or watching today. If you review the show and you give us a positive review, that allows the show to find a larger audience organically. And most importantly, if you feel like there's somebody out there out in your professional network that would benefit from the conversation that I had with Kieran today, don't forget to share the show. So with that, we'll thank you again for coming on, and look forward to getting in touch.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Cheers. Bye-bye.